Welcome to the Wackel Changemakers podcast. My name is Judy Mitchum, Director of Marketing for the Girls Day School Trust. Wackel is an organisation that brings together the most senior female leaders in marketing and communications in the UK. Every year, Wackel organises Gather, a day of inspiration and training for aspiring female leaders. This year, Gather is happening on the 23rd of May and the theme will be Changemakers. In this podcast series, sponsored by Whaler, I will be talking to some top female leaders, women who are also known to be change makers. My guest this week is Pippa Glücklich, CEO of Amplify UK, part of the Dentsu Aegis network. Pippa is a true media girl at heart. She started her career by doing work experience at Posterscope and then worked her way up the media ladder in various agencies to become the CEO of Starcom and then more recently Amplify UK. She is the current president of Wackel, which means she's a very important person. A radiant and lovely person, Pippa is inspirational in her resilience, something we'll return to later. She lives in Wimbledon with her two teenage sons. A very warm welcome to Pippa.
You forgot to mention Digby, my dog.
Oh, the dog.
With. Yeah, he's like my baby, my extra son.
Oh, so you've got three sons, really.
Three, yes. He's the one that I like the most of the time.
So
being
I'd like
mother of teenagers.
So first thing is, did I pronounce your name correctly? Because it is such a wonderful name, Glücklich.
You did indeed. I've had lots of different versions of it, but yes. And it, my father is Czech, and he came over to the UK after the war when he was 10. His father was killed in a concentration camp.
Goodness.
So quite an interesting story there. But it means, for the German speakers amongst you and our audience, it means happy and lucky in German. So I can't always testify to being both of those things, but I do my best to live up to it.
Yes. Well, generally, you are a very positive and optimistic person.
We all try.
You definitely do. You started your career working at Posterscope, and that was a graduate. You were a graduate trainee there.
No, it was properly work experience.
Okay.
Actually, I did a week's work experience after doing my O levels. Actually, because my father knew somebody that worked there, and I loved it. And then I just kept going back, and did. It was a small business then, and I did every job under the sun, from receptionist to planner to post girl. I did the whole lot. And it was actually the entry point for me to get into the industry. So the last time I worked there was in my second year at uni.
What did you love so much about it? Was it just the culture, or was it the actual job itself?
I loved the people. It was good fun, and I didn't have much experience of work, although I'd worked in, you know, pubs and that kind of stuff. The people mainly, good fun. And also I really loved the work. One of the things that I found that I wanted to get into agencies, it really helped me navigate the world of advertising and understand what the connection points were and the process. And I realised, whilst I loved out of home and still do, it's a medium that's very dear to my heart, and obviously Posterscope are part of Dentsu Aegis, so I now work with them very closely, was I didn't like being at the end of the process. I didn't like being told that it was out of home. I wanted to be the person deciding why it was out of home, or why it wasn't out of home, or why it might be digital or TV and so on. And so that led me to media agencies and understanding what the role of a planner was. And so that really gave me the insight into, well, that advertising thing looks interesting. So when I was in my final year at uni and graduating, I started to look for jobs in advertising. And then, because I'm so old, advertising agencies had embedded media departments. So I applied to ad agencies for those jobs, and I was fortunate enough to get one.
Well, I must say, I am a big fan of Out of Home, which for the listeners is translated as posters.
Oh, sorry, gosh, yes, media jargon.
Yeah, posters, having just bought a national campaign myself. But, you know, you are right at the top now of the career, of the media ladder. You must be very good at numbers if you've survived in the media side of the business this long, to be at such a senior level.
Well, do you know what? I am quite good at numbers, but I never thought I was. So
right.
When I was at school, like quite a lot of, I'm generalising now, but quite a lot of women, I think maths particularly is all about confidence, and I really thought I was rubbish at it, to the point that the school I was at said to my parents they weren't convinced I was going to pass my maths GCSE or O-level, as was then. And I thought, that's ridiculous, because obviously you have to have maths and English. And I was doing quite well in other subjects. Yeah. And so my dad had a complete panic and got me a tutor, an amazing ex-teacher who, when she was my teacher, I thought was awful, but on a one-to-one, she was on maternity leave. And I realised, just by having it explained quite simply and not in kind of lots of complex jargon, and I actually went on to do really well in maths and didn't carry on and do it for A-level. But I think it's all about, like so many things in life, about self-belief. And I'd convinced myself I wasn't good at maths, and actually then was able to demonstrate that I was and did well in the exam, to the surprise of the school and myself, actually. And since then, you know, my whole job is... Not my whole job, but a lot of my job is based around, you know, numbers and spreadsheets and things like that. Yeah,
and relationships as well.
Yes, very much so.
And of course, you're very strong in relationships.
Well, I try. Yes. I think we all try, and particularly in this industry. And it's that is the only thing in our business we have is people and their ideas. And therefore, you have to nurture them and work out how to get the best out of people.
The theme of Wackel Gather this year is change makers. You've managed quite a lot of change. You managed a merger, didn't you? Or was it an acquisition by Havas and one of the agencies?
Yes, that's right. So I worked in networks for the early part of my career, and always felt my father was a bit of an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist. And I always felt that I wanted to understand more about business. And I realised in big networks, which is where I am now, obviously, that one of the things is I didn't really feel I was learning about business and the mechanics of business and how to make money. I was learning a lot about media and how to run pieces of business, but not the mechanics of business. So I took what was considered at the time quite a leap, actually, to a lot of people, to leave IPG Initiative and go to work for a privately owned business called BLM, Booth Locket Macon. And lots at the time, I'd been working on at Initiative on Unilever, which was the biggest client, the biggest spender in the UK. So everyone thought I was bonkers. And I was there, and I had a small shareholding, and I was there for nearly 12 years. And we sold after I'd been there for 7. I always knew we would sell, but that wasn't why I joined. And it really taught me, in spades, in terrifying spades, actually, about running a business. I was named at Companies House as a director of the business, and I worked there during the economic downturn of sort of 97, 98, you know, and you have proper sleepless nights around, I might lose my house, because obviously if the business is struggling and I'm a director of the business. But I learned loads about running a business and making money and culture and people. And then the three owners wanted to sell. So we went through this kind of courting process and were acquired by Havas. And that was really fascinating in terms of managing change, because we'd gone from a business, we're about 150 people after I'd been there about 7 or 8 years. And what we found was people had joined to work for a privately owned business and for the culture of the owners. And it was great fun, and we knew everybody. So back-ending into a network, which was at times, if I'm honest, the very thing that we'd convinced people to come away from and join our organisation, and that we'd pitched constantly against. We were the wild card often on pitches, so they'd have three or four networks, all the big ones, and us. So it was a really interesting process, fascinating actually. One, bringing what we had to bear into a network and why they'd acquired us, but also trying to mesh those two cultures. Yes. And although we kept ourselves quite separate during our earn-out period, obviously we had to take the best bits of our business and the best bits of their business and convince people it was the best of both worlds. So from a change perspective, it was hard, it was really hard. And I think we probably underestimated how hard it was going to be, And inevitably we did lose some people, but then the story that we told, it was a very exciting story and it gave us a really international platform, which we tried to have, but when you're privately owned, it's you just don't have the scale. And that was one of the reasons that we sold. And so after we'd sold and I'd been there, we went through the earnout, which was 4 years. I left at the end of that, not right at the end of the earnout, but shortly afterwards, because I always knew that I wanted to go and do something different, and I wanted to play on a bigger global stage, and that's when I went to Starcom. And that in itself was another period of change,
which
but for different...
Which is one of the biggest agencies in the UK.
Yeah. And for very different reasons, another period of change coming out of a smaller network and then into a big, huge American centralised one.
Yes, I've done it myself. I totally know what you're talking about, having been in a small boutique agency which merged with a big global one.
Yeah.
It's messy.
Yes.
But you get through it.
But the learning is phenomenal, and I think there were many days I thought, I'm learning more about how not to do things than I am about how to do things. But that in itself is learning, and I'd really encourage everybody to really think about, even when you're having kind of dark times and questioning it, to think, okay, there's always learning in everything, and all feedback is a gift, I think, is, you know.
Let's talk about dark times, because we talked about change, and you have had to deal with some very traumatic personal change in your life. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I can. Very tragically, 2.5 years ago, almost to the day actually, my husband of 21 years, we've been together for 21 years, I woke up one morning, we went to sleep that night, and I knew he was struggling a bit. He'd had on and off depression, but hid it very well. And I woke up one morning and he wasn't there, and he'd left his phone, and I just thought he'd gone to walk the dog or gone to the gym or anyway, and I was right in the middle of a big pitch. So off I went to work, tried to phone him, but he'd left his phone, and didn't get hold of him, obviously. And then that night, and he'd never done anything like that before, phoned his parents, was he there, just didn't know where he was. But I'm a real worrier by nature, and I convinced myself by the time I got into bed that I was worrying unnecessarily, and he just got, even though it was massively out of character. And then the next morning, very early, he had a knock at the door, and it was the police to tell me that he'd taken his own life the day before. And it was, well, it was like having a bomb dropped on your whole life. And I've got two children, as you mentioned, and we just didn't see it coming. Still don't, actually. And I don't think I will ever come to terms with the shock of it and the unexpected nature of it. And that is, and I think I've changed enormously since that happened.
How have you changed?
I think it it just frames everything.
Yep.
It really brings into sharp focus, life is short, and live every day, because you don't know what's going to happen. And there, of course, suicide is a very complex way to die, and a very complex form of grief, apparently the most complex. And it leaves you with so many unanswered questions and unsaid things. And so it has really made me think about what I value in life, how I spend my time, who I work with, and what kind of purpose I serve, if that doesn't sound too grand. And I think it has reframed everything, and there will never ever be anything good that has come out of it ever. But I would say it has probably, I don't know whether my team would agree with this, but I think it has probably made me a better leader. It's made me value what I was, so one of the things that happened, as I said, the week that Michael died, I was really, frankly, had up my own arse, excuse my language, am I allowed to say that, on this pitch, and it was the most important thing in my life, and I was working day and night on it, and I knew he was struggling, but he'd struggled before, and I look back and think, should I have done, had I not been so obsessed with work, would I have would I have noticed? Would I have had different conversations
with
him?
Because it was all-consuming, the pitch. And
it was all-consuming. And of course, yeah. One of the things, you know, having read lots and lots of books about suicide and so on now, is that if someone doesn't want to tell you stuff, they're not going to tell you. But that doesn't mean to say there aren't things I think should I have picked up, or did he feel he couldn't tell me? And so I really try as much as I possibly can, which I think is a good mantra for everybody, but I have really learned it in spades, is not to have any regrets, is to do things that you don't look back and think, God, I wish I'd done that differently, or to, you know, think I didn't behave in the way that I should have done. So
right.
That's really become a way of life, doing the right thing. And quite often I think we instinctively, particularly in business, you do things that you might think are the quickest way or the, you know, the best way for your business, not necessarily the best thing to do. And I think that has been quite a good guiding light for me since he died.
You must have had a whole roller coaster of emotions dealing with that, and I know you're still dealing with it. Mm. It's not something that's over, it's still
no.
with you. How? At what point did you feel like you could start coping again with normal life and going back to work?
It took me quite a long time, actually. I remember saying to work, the funeral was 2 weeks later, that I was going to come back to work the week after the funeral. And then I said, actually, I probably need about a week just to sort some things out.
Yes.
In that kind of shock, I'll just keep going.
Yes.
And like a lot of women do, the world can't keep turning without me. What on earth is going to happen? I've got to go back to work. I've got this big bloody pitch that I'm doing, and I've got children, and both my parents are ill, and all sorts of things going on. And in the week after the funeral, I completely crashed and burned and fell apart. And it took me a few months to come back from that. And I think what I realised was that what I lost was not just my husband and the father of my children and the person I thought I'd be with the rest of my life, but I lost my sense of self, because I'm a very independent woman. I've you know, worked all my life. I've always earned my own money. But my whole life, being in a relationship with him and being together with him for so long, I'd been with him for more than half my life.
Yeah.
And it touched so many parts of my life and his life. So, suddenly I had to think about being the sole parent and not a co-parent. And suddenly I was the only breadwinner, even though I had always been mostly the major breadwinner because he was a teacher. I was the only breadwinner, and dealing with all the things that come with it, and I totally lost sense of myself, and I did not recognise myself. I'd gone from somebody running a multi-million pound business and a big team, and I was president of Wackel
yes.
at the time it happened, first time round. And I just organised my first dinner with Tom Daly. We'd just come back from holiday. There were all these things. And I just went from what I thought was probably
yes.
a real bubble, got a very privileged bubble, to my... It burst spectacularly.
And you had to look after two wonderful teenage sons who were also dealing with...
Yeah.
Tragedy.
Yeah, and it was, and I wasn't very good at it to begin with. I was, in fact, I'll be honest with you, and I feel terrible saying it, but for quite a few months, I felt very resentful to them, because I thought, do you know what? I just don't want to be here. This is too hard to deal with. There's just too much. It's too difficult, and I don't know how I'm ever going to get through it. And everybody kept saying to me, but you've got to keep going for the boys, and you know, you've got to make them your priority. And I felt that they were barrier standing in the way of me,
yeah.
and I had to keep strong, and I had to put on this front, and I didn't feel like I could. So
because you felt like you were crumbling inside.
I was completely crumbling outside and inside, except so they'd go off to school and I'd sit and cry, and then they'd come back and I'd try and, you know, get myself together. So it took me, I'd say, I went back to work about 4 or 5 months later, and when I look back on it, I think even now that was probably too soon.
Yeah, you've said to me before that you felt like you tried to bounce back and re-establish your life as it was before.
Yeah, and I think I very much did that, and I partly did that because, you know, understandably, there was a bit of pressure from work to come back. And you know, partly the routine of work is a good thing. And I wanted to show the kids that, you know, I could still put one foot in front of the other. But I think with hindsight, it probably... I went back to trying to be Superwoman that I was before. Not that I ever was Superwoman, but I think in my head. And I realised relatively quickly that I was a different person and that actually so much had happened. Yes. I hadn't really given myself, I don't think, the mental space to deal with it. I'd kind of crumbled and then tried to pull myself back together and go back to being who I was. So.
And there's an element of going back onto the same merry-go-round that you were before just to re-establish normality, and yet it's a completely different world. You're not the same person, so you can't do that.
And I think I was really anxious. I didn't want it to define me. I didn't want to be poor, tragic Pippa, and everybody knew. You know, you could see when I walked into the office or when I saw people in the industry, their faces, and people don't know. You know, we're talking a lot about mental health these days, but suicide is still a very taboo subject. And people don't know how to deal with it, and I don't blame them, because, you know, I didn't know how to deal with it, and frankly, in many ways, I still don't. But I think that, yeah, I so didn't want it to define me, want it to define me, that I think I tried to be the person I was and make everybody forget that this terrible thing had happened to me. And then, after a while, realised that it unfortunately... is part of who I am. It is part of my story. However much I wish it wasn't, it is.
And it's incredibly brave of you to share this with us, because there is this perception, picking up on an earlier point you made, that a lot of these fabulous female leaders are just superwomen who've not had to deal with these kind of big issues, and many of them have had their own individual barriers to overcome, and you've had a particularly traumatic one.
I think everybody has different challenges.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, they're just at different times in their life. And I think, I mean, obviously one of the reasons for the podcast is to talk about Wackle Gather, which is something that I've been involved with. And I think it is the best thing, as well as the FLA, the Future Leaders Award, that we do, and the thing that I am most proud of. And as you know,
you've been
on the committee.
You've been a chair of Wackle Gather.
Yes, yeah. And I love it. And I think one of the things, the first time I went to Gather when I was on the committee, and there were some amazing women on the stage, amazing Wackle women. You know, Roisin Donnelly from Procter & Gamble, Rita Clifton, these amazing, amazing women, Carolyn McCall, Cilla Snowball. And they were doing the If I Could Tell You One Thing. And they all, I realised that they all had deep insecurities, all thought they were going to get found out.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there thinking, how can you be thinking that about yourself, because you're amazing and you look great and you've got a very successful life and career? And I realised there's that real kind of common thread amongst women, not all women, and I'm not saying it doesn't exist amongst men at all, but I think I'd say that kind of lack of self-belief and that voice on your shoulder is something that most women would recognise.
The internal critic.
Yes, yeah. And I've, you know, my internal critic is... you know, still unfortunately has a loud voice in my head. And I think that's what's so brilliant about it and very humbling about it, is it neutralises everything. It doesn't matter what your title is or how long you've been in the business, but actually, at its core, we're all the same.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the most fantastic things about the day. And it's not just for, you know, rising stars in the industry or women who are relatively new into the industry. I've been in the industry for over 25 years and I still sit in that audience and feel inspired and excited and come away going, right, okay, here's what I'm going to do next and here's what my vision is going to be. And I think it is, if you could bottle what happens in that room on that day and sell it, then you and I would not be sitting
here,
Judy.
There's a good business idea.
We would be in the Bahamas, in our villa, or doing something like that. But it is such an incredible day, and I'm so thrilled to be a part of it and to be coming along this year.
So that's on the 23rd of May this year, 2019. So do get your tickets for that.
Yes, because it's selling out fast.
Selling out fast. Tell me what it's like to be the president of WACL, and what does that entail?
It's fabulous, actually. It's an enormous honour, particularly so because, as I mentioned, I was president. In fact, when Michael died, it was 3 days before my president's drinks, at the very start of my year. And when everything fell apart, I just thought I was going to forfeit everything. And I have had to forego a lot of things since he died. And I realised, I didn't even think about it for ages, but the WACL community were incredible. And I realised that I didn't want to forego it. It was one of the things that I would look back, going back to my point about not having regrets, and think, I really regret, and probably would resent him for, and I haven't felt angry with him, bizarrely. So I thought, I don't want... He will define me if I don't do this. And the WACL community were amazing and said, you know, in time, we'd love you to come back and do it again. So I feel extraordinarily privileged.
So you stepped down.
Because I stepped down
early on and then came back in your second year to re-establish yourself as WACL.
Yes, so sort of 2 years after he died. And it's really interesting because the club's been in such a different place. Since then, I was quite involved in rewriting our purpose about accelerating gender equality in our industry. And it's been brilliant. It's such a fantastic opportunity, so many amazing women. And probably the bit I love the most about it is of our three pillars is the campaigning bit. That's the bit that I'm, you know, so I've done a gender parity. Well, we do the inspiration and the support stuff in spades, and of course we can always do more of that, and we will continue to challenge ourselves to do more of that for our members and also for all young women and anywhere, but and particularly then women in our industry. The campaigning element is relatively new to us as a club, even though it's something that we've talked about. We probably haven't been vocal about it.
And the campaigning is, for example, for equality, for the gender pay gap.
For gender parity, yeah. For all of those things. And it's just to have equal opportunity in our industry for women and to see the value that women bring to the same level as men. We don't want more or better than men. We just want the same opportunity. And in our industry, we do have a gap, a leadership gap and a pay gap. And I think the industry and the work and the ideas would be better if we could, you know, adjust that gap and make it much more equal. And I feel a responsibility as WACL, as a group of senior leaders, senior female leaders, that we should use our voice to influence and shine a light on what needs to change. So that's the bit that I'm loving.
Yes, finding a voice for women at this time, which is very exciting for women in the world, I would say.
Yeah, it's very pertinent.
Well, let's just finish the podcast by talking just about something very close to your heart, which is not about WACL, but which is about Chelsea Football Club.
Oh, yes, please. Well, perhaps not
How
at the moment.
How come you were so excited about Chelsea Football Club?
Because I grew up in Southwest London. And so I've grown up as a Chelsea fan.
And you have two boys, of course.
I have two boys, and we're big Chelsea fans. And, you know, like any club, we have our ups and downs. We're having a bit of a down at the moment, it has to be said. But I love it, and we go. I'm very fortunate in that we've got three season tickets in the family. My brother has one, and my dad has two. And actually, it's been a really good thing for me and the boys to do together. We used to do it, but Michael used to come as well. And it's been quite a good leveller for us. And we talk about football and we watch it together. And yeah, so I love Chelsea. I love going to Stamford Bridge. So,
well, bizarrely, the GDST, which is all about girls, is about to do a big event at Chelsea Football Club with the help of people like Silas Noble.
Fantastic! Oh, can I come?
Fantastic. You must come.
I'd love to.
But I know I thought it was so fascinating that you are an avid football fan. So,
and it's the Women's World Cup coming up this summer. I'm really excited about that. And Chelsea...
Not surprisingly, I didn't know that.
Well, and Chelsea are in the semi-finals of the Women's Champions League.
Well, on that note about football, which I know absolutely nothing about, I'm going to say a very big thank you to Pippa. I want to say thank you to Mediacom and the team there who have allowed us to put this together. Thank you to the team at the GDST. And a final reminder to everyone to get their tickets for WACL Gather, which this year is on the 23rd of May 2019. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. And yes, see everybody on the 23rd of May. It's going to be wonderful.